Welcome to this week's 2 Men in the Middle. This is where 2 men in the Midwest get together and talk about politics and current events. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Kinnick.
Once again, a rare Saturday podcast for us as life, work, other things conspire against the amateur podcaster at this point.
That's right, especially nearing the end of the year with the holidays. Crazy time.
So how... I've warned everybody at work. I get extra grouchy over the holidays. I'm not a big holidays guy. It's not that I don't like Christmas. I don't like all of the kind of inconvenience items that go with it. Are you a big holiday person, Brandon? Do you really like the holidays?
No, I mean, the type of holidays I like are, you know, 4th of July, you know, Memorial Day, those kind of casual, just kind of leisure holidays. Not so big on Christmas and Thanksgiving because it's rushing around. It's trying to check off boxes, make sure you see all the family, buy gifts. I mean, it's hectic.
And we've talked, you're a single guy. You don't have any kids.
That's true.
Do you find, too, that your time is just irrelevant at holidays?
Oh, yeah. I just get told where to go and when to be there.
We don't need to ask you because I mean, you don't have any.
I don't have any kids. I have nothing to, you know, no concern. So that's the mentality.
I don't want to take a huge dive into this, but at work, I was like doing something and I realized, well, I just discount your schedule because you're single. This person at work,
biggest pet peeve.
Does that happen to you all the time, I'm assuming?
Yes, and I hate when people do that at work because they're considerate people with families and like, oh, well, you probably need the extra time to do that. But single person, they're like, oh, well, you can handle that extra project or you can work the additional 2 hours because you have no life.
In the pyramid of time importance, simply because I have wife and kids, I am way upstream than you.
True.
Because you don't have those. I think it's probably how everybody approaches that.
I think so. And I think the problem is coworkers and others tend to forget that even though single professionals, they may be dating or they may be trying to, you know, have lives and get to that point, which takes time and energy and effort.
Once you have kids, you just devalue anybody. Everything is devalued except your kids and what you're doing. So.
Sounds about right.
So right over here, Kelly came out where Trump has come out and said, yeah, he'll be gone by the end of the year. He'll announce his, which by the way, the end of the year is 3 weeks away.
But hey, that's greater courtesy than he's given most of the people he's fired. Most of them have been gone on a moment's notice and that's been it. They've been like, no notice.
And that he would, in the next couple of days, he'll kind of announce who his choice for be. We were discussing that the Trump Twitter game, it's always been really good. It's gone to a different level, it seems like, in the last 3 or 4 days as the pressure mounts with indictments and stuff that we'll talk about later. But you talked about the Rex Tillerson tweet and that Tillerson has finally come out and given kind of his first interview about his time as Secretary of State and kind of being in his cabinet. This was the way. A chief of staff is somebody that was hired to be fired. It's a very tough job. I'm trying to think of, I can't think of the last president who had one ride for 4 years with them. I'm sure it's happened, but this is a rough, rough job. There was no way this was always going to happen.
It was. And if you look back, you know, Kelly was preceded by Reince Priebus, who people thought was way too passive and wasn't able to steer the president correctly. So John Kelly was brought in to clean up the mess and had the president's attention for a New York minute before the president started kind of discounting him and sidelining him.
Yeah.
And so the narrative for a while has been that John Kelly hasn't been in control. He hasn't been as effective. He's been sidelined. And so it was a question of when, not if, and now that has happened. And Rex Tillerson, who was the Secretary of State, who was unceremoniously fired via tweet. So he came out at an event and basically said that, you know, his time was spent trying to keep Trump from doing things that were illegal, trying to steer him away from that. So Trump has to react, as he always does, and he tweets out that Tillerson is as dumb as a box of rocks and he's lazy. And so it's par for the course. And it's another example of Trump cannot let anybody say anything that's even slightly unflattering or critical without there being a just over-the-top response.
So Rex Tillerson ran one of the largest corporate organizations,
ExxonMobil,
most complex organizations in the world.
Right.
And he even said in that he is a process, discipline guy. That's how you build a global organization. And Trump is a completely by the gut. I think what really hurt Trump is when he came out and said he doesn't read, he doesn't look at anything, he doesn't consider anything except his own gut. And if you tell him anything other than that's the greatest thing I've ever heard, Mr. President, we'll make that happen, there's this frustration that happens, and eventually it boils down into a relationship that doesn't work. I think for me, this is to break it down into terms that I can understand. Have you ever had somebody at work that you hired somebody to fix somebody else's behavior? Or when you ask somebody, why was they hired? They're like, well, this guy sucks at this, and this guy's going to fix that guy.
Right. I've seen that multiple times. Yeah.
Has that ever worked?
That usually never works.
It never works. When Kelly was hired to kind of fix some things with Donald Trump to keep him on task and change some of the things about his style, those were destined to fail.
Yeah, he was set up for failure. I mean, yeah. It only goes so far if that person is willing to listen and heed advice and have that that person take control, and Trump's not willing to do that.
He's not going to do that. I hope Tillerson sits down with some more journalists, because I mean, this is the stuff that the entertainment value of this is so high. And those two, Trump and Tillerson, from day one, they were never going to merge together. That was never going to work. Tillerson called Trump an effing moron.
Right.
I think Trump never got over that. These are stories that, just for take the politics aside, the entertainment value of that is pretty considerable.
Oh, absolutely. And we knew this White House was chaos, but now we get the details of that chaos, and that's what makes it so intriguing, because we get an insider view that we wouldn't otherwise have. And I expect he'll speak more. You know, there's others in the White House who have since left that I assume will probably be speaking out as well. So it'll be this slow kind of drip of unflattering information about working in the White House. And let's be honest, at this point, no one in their right mind, no one will go and work for that White House. It's a career-ending move. And it's been, I think, those who have worked in it, I mean, it's been detrimental to them. And they lose credibility. So, you know, at this point, if you look at who's being talked about as the replacement, it's this Nick Ahrens guy, I think. Pence's chief of staff, who's a kind of RNC operative, kind of younger in his 30s. You know, he's very ambitious. But, you know, outside of that, there really wouldn't be anybody else, because anybody that's mature, career-minded knows the ramifications. They're not going to take that on.
So being chief of staff is probably like the third or fourth most powerful position outside of the presidency.
Yeah, because you decide what the president sees and doesn't see, what comes across his desk. Well, I should say with the normal presidency.
Yeah.
You know, this is all bets are off.
And the cabinet
in this case
reports through you.
Right.
And your job also is to work the Hill, to work the Senate, to work the House. You were there. You are the kind of rod that rams the agenda through not only the legislative branch, but through your own cabinet as well.
Right.
You keep everybody in line. That job cannot happen in a Trump administration.
No.
There's no way.
Because, I mean, you don't have control over the agenda. I mean, you're always lacking control or losing control if you have it. And you're, like you said, you're supposed to be the liaison between the different agencies and agency heads and departments, as well as Congress, and filter information through. But, you know, you can only go so far. If you don't have the support from the president, you can't be effective, which we've seen. And the president tends to circumvent people and go through all kinds of backdoor channels, as we've seen him do. You know, he'll get advice from, you know, members in Mar-a-Lago on policy, and you know, that's how he'll make decisions.
He's
sometimes
just taking input from multiple sources, Brandon.
You know, call up Sean Hannity, Geraldo.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
So you can't be effective if it's complete utter chaos.
And do you think anybody else calls it quits at the end of the year? I wouldn't be shocked if, like, Kellyanne Conway.
I was going to say, Kellyanne Conway would be the first one who I would think, you know, and it's interesting, and, you know, I would only comment on it because it's so public, but the dynamics of her and her husband's relationship with his being so vocal.
They're putting it out there. They're not hiding it. They're putting
they're
it
putting
out
that
there.
They're putting that out there. But and then it was interesting because you had Eric Trump actually comment on that, which is completely like none of his business, and to make a comment about her husband being disrespectful to
and
her
George
work.
George Conway is a pretty serious lawyer.
Yes.
He is one of the top conservative legal minds in the country.
Oh, yeah.
If you're going to pick a fight with that guy and argue with that guy, you should expect to lose because that's what that gentleman has done at a very high level for a very, very long time.
Right.
I could see her. I kind of put people into this category of might want to have a career after the White House, because to the point that you were making, you are so toxic maybe when you come out there. Kelly doesn't care. Tillerson doesn't care. You know, they're at the end of their careers. Tillerson's got to be sitting on a mountain of money. Mm-hmm. He'll write a book or something. I think Kelly will just go into retirement. But the group that's younger there, I mean, they typically, one of the benefits of working in the White House is you pivot that.
Opens doors,
to
yeah.
Other opportunities. Who is Sarah Huckabee Sanders going to work for?
That's what I wondered. And I would have thought she would be one to, you know, go for the exits. But I would have thought she would have left a while ago. And she's lasted as long as she has. So yeah. I don't know what her end game is, if she's just trying to stick it out as long as possible because she doesn't see as many opportunities post White House, which could be it as well.
Kellyanne Conway, before she got to the White House, you know, my wife and I were joking that, you know, if you were like Exxon and the Valdez runs aground in Alaska, you want Kellyanne Conway to be the person that gets out in front of that. The way she can articulate one side of a story, we could call it spin, you can call it whatever you like, but she is very good at that.
Yeah.
But her 2 years in the White House has painted her in a completely different picture that really, I think, prevents her from any type of corporate or future government job that she would be open for.
Well, because Kellyanne Conway is really good at branding and, you know, being able to go out there with the narrative.
She is.
But she's had to go way beyond just traditional spin, political spin, and actually, you know, reinforce downright lies and completely just change the subject. I mean, so it's put her in this very difficult position where she's lost credibility as well. And she's been longtime respected pollster, heading her own polling company. She's been in Republican politics for decades.
She's been forever.
Yeah. And so, you know, what does this do to her future too? That's a problem. Everybody seems to be tainted by this administration and they don't escape unscathed because in one way or the other, they have to answer for the administration. They're put in defending positions that they can't defend. Trump does them no favors.
No. So I've started calling Trump the Etch-a-Sketch president because I think that when he's done, everybody, Republicans predominantly, will literally shake their head and say, Trump who? They will deny any knowledge of Trump as a president. I think the second he's gone, there will be a pivot to, we need to heal the nation, we need to be one, blah, blah, blah. Those talking points will resurface, and there will be no examination of what Trump was, what he did, and everybody will disavow that they ever knew the man, talked to the man, or that he was ever president.
Yeah, I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see the first judgments post-Trump and how history addresses this and how that's addressed in entertainment and various forms of media because
entertainment Vice is coming out,
right.
The movie about Dick Cheney, the three movies about Trump that will surface in the first 4 years after he's gone, you've got me thinking about that now, and that's going to be outstanding.
Well, look at the book Game Change, you know, and how, you know, that just, you know, rocked the political world when that came out.
Did Game Change? That's the Sarah?
That's, 2008 election,
yeah.
Barack Obama,
that's
Sarah
the
Palin,
HBO one.
And they made the doc, HBO.
Yeah. Have you seen that movie?
I have,
It is outstanding.
It's really good, yeah.
Yeah, Sarah Paulson's in that.
I'm trying to think who played Sarah Palin. Great actress.
Yes, damn it. It'll just fly out.
I know. Redhead, it's on top of my head.
Boogie Nights. Of course, I only know the actress who had a porn star in, but yes.
So it comes to mind, yeah.
Great actress.
Great actress.
We'll get her name, but that movie, you're right. The movies like that are devastating to
Julianne Moore?
Moore. There it is. Thank you. Those movies are devastating to the political person they're aimed at. Think of W, if you've seen that movie from Oliver Stone. You're right. What comes next for Trump after the presidency is nothing pleasant.
No.
And the people who rode with him, his ride or die crew, if they make it to the end, there's no happy ending for those folks either.
No, not at all. I mean, I think history is going to judge this point in American politics as like an aberration, like a very like anomaly. And there'll be many attempts to try to explain it.
Oh, yeah. And there'll be a lot of distancing from it, too, I think.
Oh, yeah. And you're going to see, people who were on the inside and say, hey, you know, I wasn't a part of this. I tried to kind of rewrite
the I was trying to steer from the rear excuse. Right. I don't think that's going to fly.
No.
I was reading on Huffington Post today when they announced Kelly. They rehashed some of his things with Porter, the White House.
Oh, yeah. Very embarrassing person. Episode. Yeah.
And that was not his best moment. And there were times again where I think he showed a little bit of his inability. This is Kelly to reflect what's happening in society today, be a little bit more aware of his speech. And I think Kelly made an honest effort with Trump, but Kelly also had some limitations that also played into him not being successful as well.
He did. One of the biggest criticisms of him was that he wasn't very attuned politically to, you know, how events, how outcomes, decisions would play. And so he didn't have that political savvy that is kind of required to.
He didn't have the relationships either.
He didn't have the relationships. Yeah. He's a career military guy. Yeah. I mean, he hasn't worked in the political arena ever. So that's. Yeah. You know,
so
help.
Kelly leaves. Other people will probably leave. This is just par for the course. This is going to be just however long Trump is president, this will be a constant churn of folks. The idea of getting the best and brightest is not going to happen. At this point, you kind of take what you can get and you hope for the best.
Yeah, that's all you can do. I mean, the turnover in this White House just in 2 years has been just staggering. If you compare it to, you know, Bush and Obama, I mean, it's off the charts, nowhere near.
Pivoting to Bush, was Baker his? I know Baker was his chief of staff for a while, wasn't he?
Baker was,
or he was Secretary of State.
Yeah, okay. Baker was his Secretary of State. Yeah.
So thinking, you know, Bush died. God, almost 2 weeks ago, I think. And the last week and a half, really, I thought the media did a really nice job as kind of a celebration of who he was. And I think it's one of the reasons why I think we have an appetite right now to remember the normalcy of the U.S. president. And nobody brought those characters in the focus more than Bush the first did.
Right. And, you know, his presidency, I think, was a very understated presidency. And you know, being a one-term president, that had to do a lot with it. But I think that the lens of history will judge his time in office much better than we judged it at the time. You know, and you can't take for granted the fact that his tenure oversaw the collapse of the Soviet Union.
He was there when it fell.
The fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, the transition of Eastern Europe into democracy, which you can't. You know, George H.W. Bush had phenomenal relationships with European leaders at the time. You had former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney that was at his funeral and spoke. Yeah. You know, because those relationships go back. I mean, he was CIA director. He was vice president.
Absolutely.
You know, he had all of these roles in the public arena.
Yeah.
But the other, I think, key thing to remember with him, he also oversaw, you know, which is interesting, the Clean Air Act. You know, that was signed under his presidency, as well as the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Things that
landmark.
Would be gutted today.
Oh, today, absolutely. I mean, and you can argue that the current administration is actually working to
gut his legacy.
Right.
What struck me about all of the press and activities around Bush the first was the depth of this man. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it, vice president, CIA director, congressman, ambassador.
Right.
We used to highlight those things and say you needed to
experience mattered. Yeah.
Some of this experience before we would look at you for the presidency.
Right.
And I think that's something that in the post-Trump era, that will be very interesting to see if we go back to, you have to have some basic qualifications in the government to try to run for its highest office.
Right. Another thing, too, is you can disagree with George H.W. Bush on policy. Plenty did. You know, he was very thoughtful and pensive and introspective. So absolutely. Everything the current president isn't. And he had this kind of humility about him as well. And, you know, I think one of the, unfortunately for him, he in many ways lost his base to Ross Perot when he raised taxes and went back on that campaign pledge. But
did Perot get like 22% of the vote
nationally?
Or
22% of the vote nationally.
He got this outrageous percentage and he of that vote.
He did well in enough states to throw the election to President Clinton.
Absolutely.
Because in those close races. And but in some ways too, the economy that that ended up booming under Clinton was somewhat inherited from George H.W. Bush. Those decisions made to get the deficit under control and to raise taxes, you know, and so he didn't get to see those. But I think one of the most touching moments, and this has been talked about again and again and again, because of how polarized we are, is that letter that President Bush left for President Clinton.
Yeah.
You know, despite them having a very difficult, you know, very hard fought campaign. Yep. You know, he said he wanted him to succeed and wished him the best and left that letter. And then the two men became really great friends later in life and partnered on, you know, charitable initiatives and traveled the world together.
Yeah, so I remember, I think it was 1992. I remember being in college in a political science class, and I was the only one arguing that an Arkansas governor has no chance of defeating a sitting president that has the background of Bush and who just executed a successful global military action.
Oh, his approval rating was 90% after that.
Clinton is, he is a joke compared to what Bush is, and he is going to get wiped off the planet, that this is going to be a slaughter. I think one of the things that, and to follow what you said, lots to disagree with from my side on Bush's policies. A lot of things he did around the war on drugs, a lot of things with AIDS and the LGBTQ movement. There's a lot to debate of what was good or bad, but the character of that man, the depth of the man, that was never in question when it comes to him. And I think that's, you know, taking jabs at Trump about the funeral, I don't know about that. I mean, Trump does so much. You don't have to look for the small, petty-ish things.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's just impossible for Trump to come off as a human being.
He does.
It's just not.
Well, I don't know if you read some of the reports that circulated from insiders in the administration said that, you know, Trump post the funeral was, you know, his thoughts were on his funeral and whether it would be to the level of Bush's and, you know, the pomp and circumstance, because that's what he is always focused on.
He just can't do it.
And he always looks uncomfortable if he's at an event where he's not the center of attention.
Absolutely. And there's that weird high arms crossed.
The frown, twiddling his thumbs. Fat. He kind of doesn't know what to do.
He sits his arms on his gut and just sits there and looks all, you know, pissed about everything. So yeah, those are easy shots to take.
This funeral was very different, though, than John McCain's, that there was no direct, you know, punches to Trump, you know, in the oratory and the speeches that were given. The closest that came to that was John Meacham, who's the official biographer of the president. Yeah. He made a couple of comments that were contrasted Bush with Trump without naming Trump, but talking about his humility and introspection and how, you know, represented a different time. But it was very indirect. Yeah. I mean, nothing that we saw confrontational like during McCain's.
So Meacham was a guest speaker at a corporate retreat where my wife works.
Oh, really?
And he was phenomenal. She said instead of like having a comedian this year, they had him, and he was unbelievable. And he's a pretty sharp guy.
He is. And his books, I highly recommend anybody who wants to really kind of inform themselves on deeper aspects of the presidents, because his books are phenomenal.
So this week was I hate to say good, because a man did pass away, but it was also a man who lived to 94, had the richest,
had
fullest
a full life.
And did it surrounded by the love of his family. And I think all of us fantasize that when it happens, it could happen like that. But I think it was a reminder to the American people about what traditionally the U.S. presidency has been about how and what we expect out of the president, not only when they're in office, but out of office, and just by the sheer starkness of the contrast from Bush to Trump, we got to see some of that and a reminder that it doesn't have to go this direction. If we don't want to go down this road, we don't have to.
We can go back. Choices. Yeah, we can pivot back, and this isn't. And again, just always being reminded that this isn't normal. It's easy to fall into. No. This mindset that this is the new normal, and you know, sometimes it can be difficult to remember a time when it wasn't like this because of just the onslaught and volume of information daily. But it's good to be reminded of it. You know, John McCain's funeral reminded us of that, and now Bush's has even more so because it's directly taken us back to a time, you know, when we had a very different persona in the White House. Yeah.
And sometimes it's okay to select the man or woman who's been grooming for this and kind of training for this and stepping to this.
Who has the experience, the expertise.
That's not a bad thing.
Right. And the fact is, I mean, the other thing people need to remember is President George H.W. Bush was born into a very wealthy family.
He was.
You know, New England family, like Trump. But unlike Trump, you know, he dedicated his life to public service. He could have made much more money in the private sector if he had gone that route, but instead devoted his life to public service because he believed in it, and his writings and all of his statements, you know, signify that. So again, two very different paths taken by two very different men.
Well, you want to talk about a concept in America that's completely grown out of fashion. You were born into money, and there's an expectation that you use that to service to your fellow man,
to give
to your
back,
country,
yes.
To give back. We've left
pay it
that.
Forward. Yeah. Completely behind.
I can remember when a time that those things were talked about.
Right.
But if you ask me. When that's completely dissolved. I mean, people, money is kind of an ends to a means. If you have money, the objective is to get more money. What's left of that? And is anybody or who's moving forward under that guise?
You know, that's a good point. We often, and this is a little bit into a tangent, but we talk about, like, as a society, how we've evolved in terms of race relations and, you know, many different aspects, you know, from the 50s and 60s and other turbulent areas in American history, which I completely agree. But then it feels like in some ways we've kind of lost our ethos, our moral compass. And one of those would be this expectation of, you know, if you have great wealth, you know, being able to contribute to society. You know, the whole JFK famous quote, I can't talk today.
I love that you did this and I didn't butcher this. That's not what your country
can
do
for
you,
but what you can do for your country. Thank you.
Yes, because I have butchered like 20 of these in the past 6 months. That's like your first. So you still got a lot to go to catch up to me.
But that, yeah, that seems to be lost, you know, these days. And there was that idea, but, you know, decades ago that was kind of an expectation. We've kind of moved to just make as much money as possible, take advantage of every loophole as possible. And we see that in the fraying of community organizations, these organizations, member-based organizations that do work in communities, whether it's Rotary Clubs, whether it's, you know, Lions, Kiwanis, all these groups that are just, you know, completely decline and sharp decline.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's less the social, what they call the social fabric of America as it existed is going away and it's not being replaced. And so that's a whole other, I think, argument.
As that goes away, are you worried about what steps into that void is government?
Yeah.
The state, the party, the government, as we cannot depend upon our neighbors anymore and our former countrymen. And there's no expectation that if you have more, your responsibility is to give more and to do more. That in the lack of that, what's going to take that the place of all of that is government agencies, government programs, more government dependency.
Oh, absolutely. And that's concerning in a number of ways, not only to me, you know, who cares about the growth of government, but also from a spending, you know, as far as our deficit and debt go. You know, we're already at record levels and out of control. And that's only increased substantially under Trump, not decreased, and under the Republican Congress. And so at some point, the bills are going to come home to, and it's the generations, my generation and the ones after me, that are going to
have to. You're the one that's going to take care of this mess. I mean, it's your generation, people in your mid 30s. You're not getting out of here until something happens.
Right.
I'll probably scoot out just on the end and won't
You'll make
really
it
care
out
that
fine.
Much. but and my kids will be too young to do anything about it. It's you guys that are going to have to step up and finally figure out how do you unpack this giant pile of this crap for debt.
Thank you, baby boomers.
And yeah, I like at least Trump. Well, one thing Trump does really well.
Oh, you heard him say that he's going to be dead. He's going to be gone. He doesn't care.
I'm not going to be around. I mean, I just did what everybody else did, which was, you know, do a bunch of stuff and somebody else will figure it out.
At least he's brutally honest, if nothing else, right?
It's one of his superpowers that he says things out loud that most people say in their head.
Yeah.
I think that's where... again, maybe I'm giving him too much credit for calling it a superpower, but if he thinks it, there is not a lot of, wow, I really need to package.
No, he doesn't think. Here, he does no introspection.
Here it comes.
Yeah.
So let's get into, so Friday, two Mueller briefings and a briefing from the Southern District of New York drop on Manafort, Cohn, and I think that was it. Manafort and Cohn.
Right.
So... the Southern District of New York basically says, hey, Cohn really didn't offer as much cooperation as we expected. He came late to the game. He was unwilling to get into any other areas other than specific to kind of adjacent. Well, he talked about Trump paying off the two women to not hurt his campaign. When they asked about other things, he wouldn't go there. So in federal court, there's this 5K memo that they can file, which basically says they did everything. They went above and beyond. This should really be taken into consideration in their sentencing. Cohn did not get that. And yeah, they basically said, he should probably do some jail time.
Yeah, so that's striking for a number of reasons, because we finally know the extent of his cooperation or lack of, which was always kind of a mystery.
When he made it out of, I did everything, and I'm just walking out of here scot-free because I did everything.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was wishful thinking or who really thought that he was going to make it out with this great plea deal and was going to somehow get off, but clearly that's not the case
now. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. And so, you know, and the question is, so he's provided, you know, at least some testimony that's useful. The question is how useful that's going to be in the court when, you know, now we know that he hasn't been completely cooperative, because that kind of taints him and his the benefits that he brings to the prosecution.
So. And what's really hard is as an American news consumer, how do you unpack what the Southern District means against what the special prosecutor means? Because it feels like, and how this was presented, and I agree, I totally am, I got this through MSNBC, so I may be looking down a complete bias lens that they presented that, oh, these two things are separate. Just because the Southern District wasn't happy with him over here doesn't mean he didn't give Mueller everything that he needs over here.
That's true. That could be true, and I think that's the problem, though. I don't think most Americans are kind of in the weeds on knowing the difference and, you know, the different entities that are involved and the different legal proceedings, because they are separate. And so when we get news from one, I think, you know, in the minds of most, they just see it all as kind of one investigation. It's not.
It's two totally separate
things. Separate investigations. And so that needs to people need to remember that. But I think, you know, with Cohn, you know, the jury's still out in terms of how much he brings to the table. We won't know the extent of that until Mueller's report is released and we have the details there. You know, Friday was a big day. That was also Comey testifying.
Yeah.
You know, to House Republicans.
But I think the biggest thing on Friday was that the Southern District of New York said the president directed Cohn to commit a crime, and we can prove that.
Yeah,
the crime is campaign finance, that he paid somebody to directly impact the results of an election. That is a crime, and if Donald Trump were the governor of New York, he would be indicted right now. But because he is the president, and the DOJ policy is we don't indict sitting presidents, we will just call him person of interest one or whatever that is.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll all just go about our business, knowing that the person who sits in the president's right now committed a felony by directing Cohn to pay off two women that he had affairs with to impact the election.
Oh, he was directly implicated. Yeah.
Directly involved.
Yeah, no question.
And this is where, again, that's just going to wash over us and be like, all right, I don't, okay. Trump does a lot of stuff, sketchy stuff with women. All right, we knew that. I guess, again, where is there any, do you sense any outrage over this? Unlike the Republicans, I've seen no Republicans.
There's been no reaction. That's what's been, yeah, just kind of mind-boggling. And so, again, it's like, I think the Republicans have just, you know, completely gone all in, and they're waiting until, you know, it actually drops before they, you know, flee the president. I mean, they're sticking by him until there's, you know, the evidence is right there and everything's released and they have to bolt.
It's almost like Trump, and he's been genius about this. He has crafted this whole bucket of known knowns.
Yeah.
Well, you knew I was a philanthropist. You know, I messed around with a ton of women. You knew I did sketchy shit. You knew I paid people off. You knew I had a fixer.
And we just accept it.
You knew I was a money launderer. You knew, and that list just goes on and on. So those all get dropped. Did I say philanthropist? I meant philanderer.
Philanderer, yeah.
Yeah, I said that wrong. Okay, so now we're tied. You got one, I got one.
Okay.
And it's almost like, well, that all falls into this known bucket. You can't hold any of that against me. I mean, you knew that was me going in. So anything, any activity that's that, I get a pass on all of that. And it seems like the Republicans, his base, have all just said, well, okay, that's kind of baked in the cake. So
yeah, I mean, that's cool. The threshold that we would have judged any prior president by no longer holds up.
Does not apply.
It doesn't apply to Trump.
Does not apply.
And so you figure, well, how bad does it have to be before he is held to account and we finally say, okay, enough is enough. No, that is bad. Because, you know, A, B, C, D through, you know, M and L, you know, is not bad. We're fine with that.
We just accept that.
It's just part of, you know, who he is. And, you know, we have to wait till it's actually, you know, something that is demonstrably illegal and has, I don't know what the criteria is.
And I think that's what, again, this is like the third time I've called Trump a genius, but that's his genius. Mm-hmm. He's muddied that water so much that we don't know. What does it look like when we see something that says that's over the line?
Yeah. And I think that's a problem. I think what's also a problem is that Americans are just shrugging over the fact that, you know, his statements on Twitter and, you know, criticizing, you know, those that have cooperated with Mueller. I mean, that's witness tampering to a degree. And we don't seem to care about that either.
I would think somebody from DOJ would call him and go to the White House and say, you got to knock that off. That is clearly witness tampering. You cannot do that. But
And now, you know, that we know, too, that not only was Manafort not cooperating fully, but that he was talking to Trump's attorneys, you know, recently as earlier this year. Again, that is not supposed to happen. That's, you know, illegal to have that type of involvement, like with witnesses in a, you know, pending trial.
So Cohn did. So Comey or Comey, Mueller's email or Mueller's briefing that he dropped basically said Cohn cooperated with us.
Right.
Whole bunch of stuff. Here's where I get confused. And this is where I think, again, people who believe the witch hunt narrative, I don't think people believe this is a witch hunt, but people that believe this is a complete waste of time driving home. And this comes on MSNBC, and the reporter starts this great story about how this Russian government agent contacted Cohn about, and I think the word they used was how to be synergistic between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. And it's like, here we go. Now we've got something. Now we're on the one thing that doesn't fall into the known bucket. I colluded with Russia. They walk through this whole scenario and at the end say, and Cohn didn't reply or follow up.
Yeah. Well, and part of the problem is,
then why did you just read that?
Yeah.
What was that?
And I think it feeds into the narrative that the Trump supporters want, right? Because they're focused solely on collusion.
Absolutely.
You know, collusion. Nothing else matters if you can't prove there's not direct collusion. Well, actually, that's not true. You know, we know now that there were direct contacts with the Russians as early as 2015 by members of Trump's campaign circle. So that in and of itself does not lead to collusion. But where this factors in is possible obstruction of justice. And I think obstruction of justice is the greater issue the charge that needs that'll be brought about, and that's what Trump should be worried about. So collusion is harder to prove. Obstruction of justice is not as difficult to prove, I think, based on the evidence that's, you know, starting to percolate.
Well, what's weird is obstruction's right on the edge of that bucket.
Yeah.
Would we hold him accountable for that? Would we not hold him accountable for that? That's one of these odd things, because you just mentioned the base and the supporters say the only thing that pivots the needle is direct collusion. You have got to show me collusion or I don't care. Everything else is this over here.
Yeah.
My thought on this is all of the when Mueller comes out with everything, lots of indirect evidence that any functioning human being would conclude that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. And any other normal human being, any human being would draw the connection. Trump had to know about it.
Yeah.
And then we take all of that and we just throw it away, because collusion, conspiracy, hardest thing to prove.
It is.
To prove that he directly knew and participated, next to impossible. It takes this leap to, as a normal, functioning, thinking human, you have to make this leap. We are not prepared to do that.
Yeah, exactly. But, and that's why I think that it's easy to get so focused on that and you lose out. There's a myriad of other crimes, possible legal violations related to foreign involvement in elections and payments and all of that that come into play, which again, you know, the challenge is proving that direct knowledge by the president. Yeah. But you can't overlook that, because again, the president would like you to just focus only on collusion, because I think that that's kind of a red herring and allows him to, you know, paint himself as this victim.
So we get close on collusion or conspiracy.
Yeah.
But you're right. Nobody ever fully gets there, because again, because of the bar it takes to get there is really high. The known bucket is overflowing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there is all kinds of awesome stuff in there. Obstruction, witness tampering, suborning perjury, you name it.
Right.
The known bucket is full. What do we do? And I think as a Democrat, people more talking about impeachment. If the known bucket is absolutely got everything in you need, how do you use that?
Well, and so impeachment, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors is what the Constitution spells out as criteria for impeachment. And so then it's up to the House to decide what constitutes a high crime and, you know, misdemeanor. You know, I would think obstruction of justice alone is a high crime. I mean,
you could make that argument.
And we have, you know, and without even getting into the Russia aspects of that, if you look at the president's conduct and, you know, how he, you know, firing Comey, you know, his attempts to influence the investigation, all of that feeds into, you know, obstruction of justice. And then you add on the possibility of campaign finance violations onto that, especially as they relate to Russia. There's all these loose ends that can be tied for some of those crimes. So the case can absolutely be made, you know, setting collusion aside, for impeachment if Comey is able to wrap all this up with a nice bow and, you know, connect those dots.
So let's say all that happens and the Democrats in the House, because you only have to have a majority in the House, I believe, to fire off impeachment.
Right.
So we're sitting down. So you and I are, I don't know who we are. Well, okay, I'll be Nancy Pelosi, I guess. You're another high-ranking House person.
Okay.
And the conversation is, what do we get out of impeachment? What are we trying to accomplish by impeaching Donald Trump? Because do we think that, one, do we feel we have the votes to get impeachment done? That's probably a yes.
Mm-hmm.
If we impeach Donald Trump, what is the outcome that we expect? Is this just to damage his 2020 presidential campaign? Is this to paint the Senate in a light that helps Democrats in 2020 because they could not convict him or would not convict him in the Senate? Do we feel we can get him removed from office because we can convince 23 Republican senators to vote for impeachment? I guess what I'm struggling with is if we've got this one thing that we think would do it, that we highly suspect we can get to, but we've got a mountain of everything else, what's the end game here? What really can we expect out of this?
Right. And impeachment is risky. And there's a lot of risk on the part of Democrats. Yeah,
there's a lot for the Democrats to go horribly wrong with this.
So I think, number one, it'll depend, too. I think they'll be looking closely at polling, gauging American reaction to Mueller's findings after those are released and what Americans think and how that diminishes the president and how that affects his approval ratings if they go down even more substantially. That's going to factor in pretty heavily. They will take inventory of their caucus to know members' feelings, particularly those members that got elected in these suburban swing districts and how comfortable they are, because they are the ones that are going to be on the hot seat and have the most to lose, you know, when it comes to this. But you're right. I mean, there are – so in terms of gains and what there is to gain from this, it's a lasting black mark on – president on his term in office, Trump's term. And so it's something that, you know, even if he's not convicted in the Senate, he can never really recover from. I mean, it's permanent. And it gives the Democrats a message heading into the election. The other possibility is it sours the electorate on, you know, that this is an overtly political process.
True.
And that there was nothing effectively that came out of it other than, you know, they're making a statement.
Yeah.
And so that could galvanize Trump's base leading into 2020 to really get out there. The reason that's so difficult to gauge what the reaction will be is that the American people are already so polarized by Trump.
Yeah.
Most people are not going to move either way, depending on this. No. I mean, Trump's hardcore base is going to be unaffected by this.
This will harden them even more.
Right. And then those that are already opposed to him, it's not going to change, you know, where they're at. So it's difficult to assess. But there's a lot more to lose rather than the gain. And so I think that's why, too, you know, strategically, why, you know, Speaker-elect Pelosi has been, you know, very, you know, reluctant to go down that road and has said, you know, we want to, you know, see what the findings are in the investigation. We want to focus on, you know, the majority and being able to kind of stop and roll back, you know, some of the Republican legislation, because you do not want to give voice yet to those in the party, the activists that are super pro impeachment, and let that derail, you know, the message when we don't know what's going to happen yet.
I think the one thing everybody's got to wrap their mind around: Donald Trump is not getting removed from office.
That's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. It takes 70 votes in the Senate. That's not going to happen. So let's take that off the table right now. Is it worth sending it over to the Senate and making them go through that exercise? Maybe.
Well, and the Senate map is much more favorable to the Democrats in 2020. A lot, several states that the Democrats look to pick up seats.
Yeah.
So it could be in their best interest to make those incumbent Republicans who are facing tough reelect battles to cast a vote.
Yeah.
And put them in the hot seat.
Let me say this to all of my Democratic friends out there. This is impeachment is a totally political process.
Completely.
The truth, what is right, what is wrong, has nothing to do with this.
We saw that in 1998.
Absolutely. This is a political calculation.
Right.
So let's take the mature approach to this. This is not something that, well, we have to do this because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. If that was what the founding fathers wanted, they would have made it very straightforward that the president could be indicted for a crime.
Right.
Because they didn't. They made this a political process. So everything that you're talking about, calculations on winners, losers, 20, all of that has to come into play.
Oh, yeah.
And we shouldn't be disappointed if the political calculation is it's not worth it. Or it's only worth doing this much, and then we're going to pivot and do something else. Because I feel like the only thing that loses the 2020 election, presidential election for Democrats, is the candidate we choose.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. That's the only way we can totally screw the pooch on this.
Right.
So let's slow walk this a little bit. I'm also a big believer in there is no better advertisement for the 2020 Democratic for President show campaign than Mr. Trump himself.
He himself.
Keep
just
him in
let
office
him speak. Keep, yeah.
as long as you can.
Keep him the focus point. And if for those that want to be reminded what impeachment is actually like in terms of the inside, you know, backroom political process. Yeah. The Atlantic this month had a really in-depth article out about the Clinton impeachment, where they interviewed all of the major players on the Democratic and Republican side and went back and forth. And it's really intriguing because you see that it's all political. It's all behind the scenes. And there was this weird dynamic that actually developed where there were some Democrats that privately actually were somewhat hopeful that the Republicans would impeach Clinton because they thought then it would help Al Gore because he could distance himself from the president. Would it be in office? And but then there were many Republicans who didn't want impeachment because they thought that it would hurt them in the general in terms of, you know, losing a lot of their House seats. So it was a very weird, you know, kind of interplay that was happening behind the scenes because it is completely political.
When you kick this process off, and I think this is what the Republicans learned when they went at Clinton, you have just pushed a massive boulder down a hill, and it's going to destroy multiple things.
You can't stop it at that point.
You can't stop it. Even if you – it's kind of like, again, if you take a shot at the king, you better kill him. If you start this process off, you better know damn well what you want out of it before you start. And I think that caught the Republicans completely off surprise because this was a Democrat. The impeachment of Bill Clinton was a win politically for the Democrats.
Oh, yes.
Republicans never saw that coming.
No. I mean, Americans were completely soured on the process and how it went. And there's a lot more to lose than there is to gain, as that showed. And that's the same this time around. Yeah.
I tried to do some research on, and I failed miserably. What were the founding fathers' intention for impeachment? Was it supposed to be something that's used frequently? Is it infrequently? There's a lot of academic studies and writings about it's the final check on the presidency, and it's the ultimate, you know, statement of checks and balances. But how was this really intended to be used? Really, there's not any really clear direction on that.
There isn't. I mean, most of it is speculative. I mean, there's many historians that speculate that, you know, the founders, you know, in that transition to a republic, were very cognizant of what absolute power looked like under a king, and so they wanted to prevent tyranny and any type of, you know, president just, you know, completely overstepping his authority. And so, you know, the impeachment was a political check on that. And some way to actually remove somebody from office because there was that great fear. You know, under an absolute monarch, there was no way to remove them from office. Yeah. They served until they died. So that's what I more often hear than not is the comparisons to a monarch.
Yeah. And even the term high crimes and misdemeanors. What the shit does that mean?
Yeah. Well, and see, I do think the founding fathers left it intentionally vague because they wanted to give the legislative branch, you know, room to justify what that is, to create the criteria. And there's acknowledgement that that could be in different forms, you know, depending on, you know, what is at stake and as history evolves. So it's
the Constitution is one of the most genius documents ever written by men. I get that. Just a couple times I wish they would have just put an asterisk and said, let me clarify what I mean by this.
Right. Like an appendix or something. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be fantastic. The appendix. We could start with the Second Amendment. Could you give us a little bit more of what you thought on that? This would be one. Instead of high crimes and misdemeanors or these eight things. Somebody does these eight things, they run out immediately. But that's not how this works. There's a lot of sloppy area where it's open to interpretation.
It is completely. And so you have politicians that are the ones interpreting it. And so, you know, and doing it through the filter of, you know, their own political well-being. And so it leaves a lot to speculation.
So what's been our last 10 minutes on Donald Trump wrote a tweet this week where he called himself Tariff Man. Now, as we sit here on Saturday, this week, I believe the stock market lost over 4% of its value,
brutal,
and wiped out all gains for 2018.
Yeah,
there have been a lot of economists starting to throw the R word, recession, around. Yeah. The 2-year cycle that Trump has been enjoying on the economy feels like it may slowly or very quickly, depending on some of his actions, start to turn. This has driven me crazy, and I need you to look at me, Brandon, to tell me I'm right.
Okay,
but again, because where I this is where I, like a lot of Americans, I think have fallen into Trump's trap. We've talked about this 1,000 times. I still Google this once a week. A tariff is not paid by a foreign government. A tariff Correct. Is a tax on goods that are imported into the United States by a private company who Right. imports them. They pay that money to the United States government.
Yeah.
So if Trump says the Chinese are paying us billions in tariffs, that is a fundamental misstatement and a lie.
Absolutely.
Because any money that we're making in tariffs are being paid, monies that we're making on tariffs on Chinese goods are being paid by American companies importing them.
Yes.
And ultimately, it is the American consumer
that those costs are passed down to the consumer. Right.
I just needed you to look at me and shake my head and say, I have that right.
You do have that right.
Because how many times has Trump just misspoke that line, missed it, just lied about what a tariff is, that I think he's got a large portion of the American people completely confused about what tariff revenues actually are.
Oh, completely. Now, the Chinese are primed to lose sales revenue and, you know, less exports mm-hmm. to the United States because of those tariffs and
which
the impact they would have.
Which
hurts their economy. But the bottom line in terms of goods and services and whose impact it is, the consumer here, goods and services increase in price. That affects the bottom line of Americans who purchase those goods and services. If we're talking about automotive tariffs, that makes the price of a automobile higher, the MSRP, what you pay. And so because, again, the manufacturers and the distributors pass that those costs down to the consumers. It also, you know, if you're talking about tariffs in the form of that are passed on the goods that are sold to, you have our, you know, farmers that are hurting. You have farms that are actually going out of business and being remortgaged because of the farm tariffs that are in place.
China which buys a lot of soybeans.
Right.
Yeah. So I looked at something too, that our overall revenue from tariffs, I believe, is like under $50 billion. It's a rounding error in the grand scheme of our
It's so small.
Economy.
Yeah.
It's
Again, tiny. You have to put that in perspective of, you know, the entire trade picture.
Since Trump's been in office, I think we're collecting something like $7 or $8 billion more in tariffs, mm-hmm. which again is nothing. Absolutely nothing in the grand scheme of our trade policy. So
Trump misspeaks about tariffs and trade all the time.
All the time.
I mean, one of the classic misstatements is when he says that Canada has a trade surplus, which is not true. They actually have a trade deficit.
Yes.
We make more off of that trade relationship than Canada
Absolutely.
Does.
But they do charge us like 200% tariff on our milk for some reason because they want to protect that industry.
Right.
It's so
they have industries they're protecting, but then we also protect some of those industries too.
Yeah.
So again, you know, on balance, both sides do have their protectionist policies. But, you know, tariffs, and especially at the level that the president's talking about, those have a profound ripple impact throughout the economy. And I think we're just starting to realize some of that, and that'll carry into next year. A lot of, you know, a lot of Trump supporters were like, oh, look, it has an impact on the stock market as soon as it hit. Well, no, it doesn't impact it right away. We're talking about its long-term impact, not short-term.
So that's an example of his superpower in just false information.
Yeah.
And just taking something that can be complicated to understand. I think most Americans think about tariffs every day. And this is, again, because we're supposed to trust the president and what comes out of his mouth. I think a lot of people think that tariffs are one thing when they're really just a tax that you and I pay is
right.
really all it is.
I usually refer to them as simplistically as a tax on consumers, because at the end of the day, that's what that is.
That's
it's a consumer tax.
The second statement he's done that really has made me scratch my head and sent me to Google to do research. And again, maybe that's another positive thing Trump is doing for America. He's forcing people to research some of this crap he says. This is one of his favorite go-to tweets. Robert Mueller is illegitimate and his investigation is illegitimate because he was not appointed by the Senate. Special counsel is not appointed by the Senate.
Right.
They are appointed by the Attorney General or the appropriate person at the DOJ.
Yeah.
There is no requirement that then the Senate then approve that person. No,
because the special counsel does not answer to the president. They are independent. I mean, they would not be appointed by the Senate in that case because it's not a nomination brought forth by the president.
Congress has the ability to appoint special counsel.
Right.
I think the only time they've done it was during the Teapot Dome scandal of 18 whatever. I just wanted to sound all smarty and say Teapot Dome. I kind of vaguely
wasn't that President Harding, I thought, and
it was something a really, really long time ago. They've done it once. So this is again where Trump takes where technically, yes, I guess that could be true that Congress could appoint a special counsel, but the way that Mueller got his job is just as legitimate as if it were done with Congress. And much more in line with the way special counsels are appropriated.
Exactly. And because that is a traditional way. Yeah.
But again, it's because he keeps saying it again and again and again. And because I call Trump all the time. And I tell my wife, my friends, when people get upset, it's like you are getting upset by the rantings of an imbecile.
Yeah.
But because he is the president, I still give him some assumption that, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that is right. And he just destabilizes so many things that are true just by using his superpower of shamelessness, where he just lies, and just continues to lie again.
Right. I mean, for him, truth doesn't matter. It's about protecting his image and giving false information to his base and keeping the narrative up and ensuring that his base continues to distrust anybody that criticizes him or is investigating him. I mean, he has to do that. He has to rely on being able to completely cast dispersions upon the Justice Department, on career prosecutors, on saying Mueller is not legitimate, on saying he has no authority, and that's how, he's able to keep up this facade.
Yeah.
Because again, if the attention isn't on them and it's on him, I mean, it doesn't look good.
So are you getting anything good for Christmas, or are you giving anything good for Christmas?
That was a nice pivot.
Just like, to hell with it. Christmas is Christmas. You get what you get. I buy what I buy. So be it.
In terms of like what I buy.
Do you expect to get anything really good for Christmas, or are you giving something especially good for Christmas?
You know, I kind of keep my expectations low in that way. When they are, surpassed, it's like, oh, that's nice. Low expectations, right?
Your facial expression matched your low expectation
for those
words.
Who can't see it,
So last question. Is it better if somebody's giving you a gift that they give you a gift that you asked for, or they surprise you with something really cool?
Oh, that's a good one.
Because I fall in the category, if I said, this is what I want, I expect you to get me what I want.
Yes. If I say it outright in front of somebody and that, it's the indication is pretty clear that that's what they're going to do, and then they don't. That's disappointing.
Even if they give you something that's pretty cool and okay, I like this, but I did give you a list of what I wanted.
Yeah,
and this was not on it, by the way. Just FYI, just telling you that.
Right. So I do think if when you set expectations like that, you know somebody who's buying the gift should deviate from that and take that chance.
I agree.
And I tend to do that. I mean, I ask when I buy for my nieces and nephews, I ask what they want, and
point to your list, tell me what you want, and that's what you get.
That's how I do it. I will say, when I was a kid, though, I was probably a bad brother, so my younger sister hated horror movies, and so my older sister asked me what my younger sister wanted for Christmas, and so I'm like, oh, I think, and that was at the time when the Grudge, which was like a Japanese horror film, came on DVD. I'm like, she would really like that movie. I'm telling you, she wants.
She has a whole box set of horror films. That's just being a brother. I mean,
so my sister actually got her that video. So fast forward to Christmas Eve, my sister's like, opening up the wrapping paper, and she sees this and immediately frowns, like, what is this?
Did you just laugh?
Not help myself. I was laughing hysterically. My older sister was super upset and hated me, but
just
it was
totally
fun.
Executed that
it was
one
so
too.
Good.
Those are the things that make Christmas fun.
Yeah.
All right. That's our hour. Thanks, Brandon.